Good day, and welcome to episode 17 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week, we're talking about poverty relief initiatives in Guelph. We have two representatives from Kindle, a local nonprofit dedicated to facilitating the creation of community support spaces, their most significant project being the Sheldale Center. And we have Pastor Kevin Coghill from the Royal City Mission speaking about all the poverty relief efforts they have underway and what they're hoping to accomplish in the next year. Our host is Dustin Brown, and we hear quite a few questions and comments from my counselor colleague, Phil Ault. We'll start with Kevin.
Sure. Thanks very much. Let me give you a little bit of history about Royal City Mission since all this hit the fan in March. So back in March, when everything shut down, we quickly knew that we wanted to be able to continue to provide for the people that were struggling the most. And so Gail and I spoke right at the very beginning of the shutdowns, and we sort of amalgamated some of our programming to make sure that there would be 24/7 care for people. So we moved some of our programming to the drop-in while they were running the 24/7 the out of the cold program, so that they were supported and that there was a meal in the evening. But when they switched from running the 24/7 warming center, they and moved to the hotels, they moved all of the shelter to the hotels. We moved back to Royal City, taking a couple of their staff. And at that point, we began serving three meals a day from Royal City Mission, 7 days a week, sending approximately between 70 and 90 meals up to the hotel for people that were in the hotel that didn't have access to food, along with another 40 to 60 people that were coming downtown. So that was a lot of meals going out and a lot of packaging. And one of the things that we learned in that time was just how much food is available during the day in Guelph. When we started looking at three meals a day, they were massive meals. There's not a chance that I could have eaten what we gave out for people. And we're not the only places that are giving food. So we decided to pare that back a little bit and move to serving two meals a day. At that time, another organization was ramping up and took on some of the food preparation and took on the job of taking food out to the hotels. So that was the seed, and they provided prepackaged frozen meals to the hotels so that people could heat them up in their rooms. And we continued working downtown, moving our meals to 11 and 6 o'clock at night. And another thing that we learned in this is, we've been working, like Phil said, about 15 years in downtown Guelph. I've been there 10 years, and our schedule we thought was great until this all happened. And we realized that having meals at different times on different days doesn't really work for people. So we've tried to be very consistent in how the timing of our meals, even though that can be a struggle for our volunteers and staff. So that went through the summer, but in the summer months, we recognized that many places were also shut down. So there was no place on those extremely hot days for people to get out of the heat. So we again switched, continuing with the meals, but we opened our doors during the hottest part of the day between 11 and 3:30 so that people could get out of the heat, have a place to get water, have access to washrooms. There's no public washrooms downtown Guelph. So just some like basic needs. And I think I heard Phil talking about washrooms earlier and urine. And I don't know, for us, we've been cleaning up human excrement the entire time I've been at Royal City Mission, because we have gardens that hide people, and a safe hidden spot is a better place to go to the bathroom than nowhere, I guess. And so we switched to being open during the day. We were lucky enough to get some summer students that really helped us in that area, but we've lost most of the volunteers. And as the cold weather has approached, we've again switched in working with Hope House and the drop-in. Hope House has offered to serve a breakfast meal, which is more continental and is awesome because that takes a bit of pressure off. Then we're serving an 11 o'clock meal and a 6:30 meal. And we're serving Monday to Saturday. And on top of that, we've just opened as we will be opening longer hours November 1st, but we're open as a warming center at this point. So everyone wants to know numbers. Currently, we're serving between 60 and 90 people at each meal. So twice a day, between 120 and 180 meals. And so some of the needs, well, of course, there's always financial needs. Packaging so far has cost us $10,000 for to-go packaging, and we are committed to not to creating as little waste as possible. So all of our packaging has been compostable, even though it's at a higher cost. We're refusing to use plastics and styrofoams. But yeah, that cost has been high, $10,000. And we're still operating without the use of many of our volunteers simply because a lot of our volunteers are either students, and students aren't necessarily back in town, and people who are retired and are higher at risk. So our staff have been amazing. We have the equivalent of 3 full-time staff running the programs, and that's all of our programs, not just the meal program. I think that's it. It'd be great if you had questions for me.
Volunteer activities, if anybody is looking for ways to fill their days or their weeks, what areas of support are you looking for?
The biggest thing right now is just being present. So because we're open for people to be there during the day, we need eyes on the building and making sure things are being cleaned. So we have at least one person at the front entrance screening people. It's a passive screening, not active screening. So we're not taking temperatures. We are following all public health guidelines. And I just happen to have my wife, Leanne, works for public health. So I have a pretty direct line to most of the information. And then it would be people who are just caring for the needs of people. So we usually have a few people there just, you know, making sure that if someone needs water, there's water available. But those people are distanced. Unfortunately, we have to have barriers between us and people, which again is a problem for people who are already pushed away. But those are the kinds of things. And also just accepting food. We have so much food being dropped off. It's unbelievable. We can barely keep up with the amount of food that's showing up.
Yes. And I understand from just talking to you last week, you do not accept clothing. It would just be an insurmountable mountain.
Yeah, that's correct. Hope House is like a block from us. So we just direct people to Hope House. They have a great clothing closet and a system for that.
Okay. The other question, it's specific to Royal City Mission. I hope that you will comment on it, because I know that there are some people that are concerned about the place of faith and missioning in support for people on the street. So I was wondering if you could talk about how overt or how ecumenical Royal City Mission might be.
Right. So interestingly enough, we have 28, first of all, this talking about ecumenical, we have 28 church partners. So that's all different thoughts of what we call doctrine in the church. So we are open to anything, and we are not overt in our, what people would call a proselytization. Of course, I have faith, I'm a minister, but that is not even something on that I would say is a mandate. It's we're just a welcoming space. We don't have any conditions for anybody to be there. And if you talk to people who come, they would say that there's no condition on anything to be there. In fact, we've had some conversations with partners because of that. So people who support us financially and bring food, and we've walked through what that looks like. And at the beginning, there was a lot of pushback, and they were going to stop working with us. But after serving, they said, "Well, no, we actually see that you guys are welcoming to everyone, and we're not concerned about this." We've walked through this many times. We've just walked through it many times. For me, my faith just means that I accept everybody. That's actually what loving your neighbor. That's my faith. If that's what I'm supposed to do, I'm loving everyone that walks in the door.
Even when you're in the wrestling ring.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Nothing says I love you like a body slam.
Okay. Okay. Thanks very much, Kevin. Just another quick one. I forgot. Police checks, because this did come up and it relates to Joe and the Rotary's concern about free police checks. Do volunteers need a police check?
It depends on the context of the volunteering. Because we always have multiple people on, we only require certain volunteers to have police checks, depending on how what kind of volunteering they're okay. doing.
Great.
Because most of our people are outside of the at-risk, not whatever it's called, vulnerable sector.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much. Sheila and Alicia, I am extremely excited about what you are going to hopefully be doing soon. And I was wondering if you could perhaps give a bit of context for that and then introduce what I personally hope will be bearing fruit in the Willow West area. And I don't know to whom I should look first, so I'll leave it to you two to flip the coin.
Alicia is completely involved in this project, and so I think we'll both probably talk. Alicia, do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, sure. I wanted to actually add, though, to Kevin's list of special skills. He's also an artist. I don't know if folks know that, but I actually have one of your pictures right here on my desk, Kevin. So shout out to you actually as well and all the work that you and your team are doing at Royal City. It's remarkable. And in regards to the Kindle project, this is actually the first time we're really getting to have a conversation about it and talk openly about what's happening and where we're at. So for those of you who don't know, Kindle is a nonprofit landlord, as Phil mentioned, and we are the owner-operator of the Sheldale Center. And so we started our journey with permanent supportive housing in the Mayor's Task Force. So have been a member kind of since inception. Always had thought it made sense for Kindle to take an active role in that, but we just weren't sure about the timing and the logistics of it. And then over the summer had some opportunity to increase capacity. And through that, at the June Mayor's Task Force, stepped up to make a formal commitment to exploring what it might mean to be the proponent of permanent supportive housing in our community, which was remarkable in itself. And the weeks that followed also had some major highlights. So what we learned really well from our partners and the drug strategy and the drop-in center and all those folks who were doing strong advocacy well before, you know, Kindle was at the forefront of this, they had really carved a path for creating discussion and making space to just start asking really key questions. And for us, that was, where are we going to get land? And so we began exploring that with the City of Guelph, County of Wellington, and then we also started to reach out to our private sector partners and had scheduled a meeting with Skyline, SkyDev, to talk about putting a greenhouse on a piece of land that is in the Onward Willow neighborhood. And it was through those conversations that they actually identified another spot of land that they would like to donate for this project. And so from there, things kind of just started to skyrocket. We now had this land commitment. And for us, that meant we could move forward with a seed application. And so seed funding will allow us to explore the pre-development costs of building a project of this nature. And so that application has been submitted, which is really amazing. And we're looking forward to hopefully hearing from that, I would say, fingers crossed, in the next 2 or 3 weeks at most. So that is great moving forward. On the development side of things, it's not my area of expertise, so I wouldn't want to speak too much to it, but we have partnered with Skyline Development, who has a whole in-house team of experts and experience in this type of development. And so they're supporting us with moving forward on the development side of things. where the supports and services come in. For those of you who don't know, I'm sure this whole group is super familiar with permanent supportive housing. It means it will be supported 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we have partnered with that, the Guelph Community Health Center, to be our lead support when it comes to that service. So we wanted to start from a place of primary care, knowing that all of our guests or tenants that will live in this building are going to have unique needs. And so to have kind of one single service provider with expertise didn't really make sense. We wanted that really holistic kind of wraparound support model. And we thought the health center absolutely had the expertise to provide that. And then one of our key questions actually that we got after our media release here the last couple of days was around, you know, who is this for, kind of question. And so for us, it's looking at our community's most vulnerable and likely using the by name list to kind of pull tenant possibilities for this building down the road. So really excited to kind of help start to fill that gap when it comes to making sure everyone in our community has a safe and affordable place to call home. So I'm sure I missed lots. Sheila, but I'll let you fill in some of the pieces there.
Great. I mean, we're super excited. You know, as Phil had indicated, we've been managing the Sheldale Center for about 18 years. And for those of you who know about the Sheldale Center, I mean, it's just a little jewel in the middle of the community that hundreds of people before COVID, hundreds of people a day would come through that center, families, kids, individuals, people in the community who just wanted to sit and have a coffee. And we're really seeing the, you know, extension of us, you know, providing supportive housing build is an extension of the work that we want to do to support community. So yeah, it's very exciting. Tomorrow there will be an announcement about the exact location. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah, the very open secret. a couple of questions before we get to questions coming from those who are attending. I'm hoping in some senses, being respectful and mindful that Gail's not here, if you could contrast that with what Parkview, the Parkview Hotel, the drop-in center project might be. I had a good talk with Dominika McPherson yesterday that laid out a couple of things that are fairly important. One was requests from the city for financial support, which I think Kendall it will also be requesting. The other is the planning process. Where are you in it? And thirdly, contrasting a new build with a renovation. I think you're able to answer some of those. Yeah. Hopefully you are.
I mean, I think to start off, I would say it's super important. I mean, and we've been very much in close communication with Gail and the Poverty Task Force and partners. There are a number of people that need supportive housing. So this is not to compete with any other project. We're working together to make sure and really just putting forward the possibilities for supportive housing. And hopefully our municipal partners will see that, you know, they're all equally valid and slightly different. But I mean, the Parkview is already serving the community's most vulnerable folks. And so Gail's project to turn that into supportive housing is really just going to enhance what's already happening in our community. You know, we've all been talking with the city about our projects, and our hope is that the city will see the value of each project and find a way to support each project in the way that it can. And the same's happening with the county. And there's lots of, you know, federal and provincial interest in supporting in enhancing housing for folks that are the most vulnerable, because it's costing a lot to house them in hotels. And I think there's a recognition that we've come to a time in our society where if we just gave people places to live, or, you know, made sure they had places to live, we'd all be, you know, everyone would be better off, and it would probably cost less. And so I think there's federal and provincial funding that will hopefully support both projects and others. You know, I don't think these are the only two projects, but the exciting piece of all of this is that, you know, the community has set a goal for ending homelessness by 2023. And I think that's doable. Like, I think in 2023, Guelph may be able to say, we don't have a homelessness problem. Guelph Wellington, hopefully. I don't want to just say Guelph, but Guelph Wellington. And that would be a very, very cool thing. In terms of the development question, I'll let Leisha answer that.
Yeah, no, thanks, Sheila. For sure. All of these projects need to happen for us to meet that goal as a community. And I'm with you. It's a matter of months and not years anymore. So I think we can finally start to share that message and say it out loud, which is really exciting. In terms of development, not my expertise, but from my understanding, which I've just been, listening in on some calls lately, the property itself does need rezoning. And an official plan change, maybe something like that. Is that the right thing? I'm looking to you, Phil, maybe for guidance, but
yeah. Okay. I didn't know that it needed those, but yes, yeah. It does.
Yeah. So I think the great thing though, and the city's been super supportive of this, is typically one would come before the other, and it looks like there might be some space to look at both in parallel. And so that opportunity would allow things to move a little bit more quickly than they typically would for projects of this nature. So that, from my perspective, seems positive in terms of development. I know if the planets align, and that's like a, you know, in a perfect case scenario, that we would expect to be building in 2021.
Yes. And there are a couple of things that that I think are important. I suspect that the reason that we have not heard any sort of neighborhood controversy about this is a consequence, similarly to what we did here about with Parkview, is a consequence of the Sheldale Center having been anchored there for some time now. And historically, there were some concerns about the Sheldale Center originally, but the buy-in from the neighborhood, and I mean the very broad neighborhood in that area, for that particular support has been fantastic. That's my gut feeling. Does that sum anything up, or am I right off base here?
Yeah, I would say that we've worked really hard to engage our stakeholders. So the organizations that provide services in and around Sheldale and the community, we've talked to some community leaders. And, you know, I mean, I think once the land location is released tomorrow, I mean, you know, we may hear from the community, but we've tried to queue ourselves up to make sure that we're answering people's questions. And so on our website, people can go and see questions, and they can email us and we'll respond. And we're really working hard to try to engage the community so that any concerns that might be there, we've already tried to build in, you know, some of the concerns into our, you know, our design work and potential concerns. And so we're hoping, I mean, everything we've heard thus far from all of the folks we've talked to has been nothing but support. I wouldn't say that that's, you know, I'm not anticipating that there won't be anyone that we call and have a concern, but we're hoping that we can mitigate those concerns. And hopefully our reputation for how we've managed the Sheldale Center will, and we also manage some housing for Family and Children's Services for older youth. And I think one of the things we've always done in our work is to always try to be good neighbors and try to manage our properties, you know.
Yeah. With relationship to that, somewhat leading, how the heck did you get Skyline or Sky Devco on board?
Well, as Leisha said, we just invited them to a meeting to talk about some property that we were thinking about using. And we were thinking about a nice big community garden. And lo and behold, they already had plans to build on the site. They were trying to find a way to build some really low, really affordable housing. And And when we talked to them about the need, the really intense need in Guelph for supportive housing, and, you know, I mean, I'm interested to hear from all of you, so we should shut up soon. But, you know, when we talked to them about the really intense need for supportive housing, and the problem is that everybody wants supportive housing, but nobody wants it anywhere near them, right? And yeah. So when we started to talk about supportive housing and the fact that, you know, property is, acquiring property is the biggest, is the biggest impediment. And you can't even apply for Canada Mortgage and Housing funding until you have an identified property. And so Kendall, I mean, was really, we had the desire. We've been talking about this for a year and a half or more, and lots of others. I mean, Gail at the drop-in, I mean, she's had her sights on a couple of different locations. And, you know, the problem is sometimes the, you know, it's the acquisition of property that's the biggest hurdle. So when Skyline said, well, we don't want to build supportive housing, but why don't we give you the land and you build it? We thought we'd died and gone to heaven, actually.
No. We had a pinch ourselves kind of moment, right?
I mean, what they're prepared to do for our community is nothing short of amazing. And it's fantastic.
I think too, just to that point, Sheila, like both Skyline and the Health Center, so our two project partners, are also like deeply rooted in that community. As well, they have a long history, multiple buildings, they are our neighbor. So they're also very invested in this neighborhood and the project. And I think like their kind of history with that also resonates through in their desire to support. So,
yeah. And just to clarify, one of the things that's important about the Sheldale is that it essentially provides one-stop full-service shopping for a community in terms of supports. And it's been I think, nothing short of miraculous in terms of how it has improved the character of that neighborhood. I'm not going to pretend that we don't have issues there. We do. We have had issues with sharps being left on the ground, with evidence of addiction and IV drug use and other things. But the interesting thing is how the neighborhood tends to pull together as a consequence of having those support services right in that area. There's a real sense that this is a home for some people. Interestingly enough, one of the things that still shocks me, and then I'll pass this over to Dustin for questions, is the number of people that live in that area that are three and literally four generations in there now, some of whom, for them, it's a big trip. These are the kids to go downtown. That's their only understanding of anything outside of the neighborhood. It's tremendously insular in some way. And then on the other hand, it's also a settlement area from which a number of new Canadians tend to move in, and then actually literally, once they get on their feet, move out. So you see a constant transformation of different cultures in that area. So this is something that I think just plays very, very well into the heritage of a community that's only been there since about 1970. Dustin?
Great, thanks, and thanks to both guests and to Phil for an excellent introduction to all these organizations and projects going on. We do have some questions in the chat, but I had a couple prepared as well. One pretty general for both actors, both sets of guests, I guess, was what have your talks been like with the various levels of government in your advocacy for your organizations, for your projects? You know, where have you encountered resistance, if any? Where have you encountered support? And we'll go back to Kevin to start with that one.
I wasn't running away. I haven't had a lot of interaction actually with levels of government, other than I've met with Phil. I would say we've had more interaction with downtown business. And some of those interactions haven't been awesome because we have been supporting the Sanguine Health Fan. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. They come to Rose City on Thursday nights, and that's been blamed for needles downtown, which there was needles downtown long before the van came. They were just used multiple time used needles. And so we've actually seen, what I've seen is last year I did a memorial for 19 people from our direct community. And this year we're way down, like a fraction of that. So all of these like safe supply or safe sharps and the CTS, they have dramatically helped downtown, even though we get, you know, there's still perceptions of things. So actually last night they were putting a sharps receptacle just on the corner of our property in the city. Like it's going in today, I think. And so we'll have a larger one right outside that can be used. But we haven't had any resistance from any level of government. We've had support, honestly, I have just been working. I haven't even had time to get out to have those conversations.
Kevin, just following up on that, because this was a project that I had hoped you would be able to do, and so far it's not happened. You had made mention of the bathrooms downtown, and right now you do have a porta potty there that provides some relief, no joke. But you and I had talked about the possibility of almost what I'd call a full service bathroom being put into the Chalmers Center, and also what I thought was really interesting was the capacity of Chalmers to actually be a supportive housing site at some point. Have you entertained that in any serious manner and had any input from any level of government?
We haven't entertained that at any serious level other than dreaming. So for those, maybe those that don't know, when we bought the Chalmers building, we found plans in the vault, and there is a third level that was a shelter that was planned. It's never been built. So, but the building is set up that it could be built on top of that. We've thrown that back and forth. We're not sure that it's good for us to be a landlord type place, because you're giving a meal and then you would have the same people living there. We don't know. We've thought about that, but the bathrooms are a huge thing. Our bathrooms are in need of help, and we have space to expand them and make them safe. First of all, because right now they're single use washrooms that are locked and large, so you can have parties in there, which is good at some level, but they're also problematic in that people lock themselves in, and we have we can't get in unless we actually open it up and then someone's directly there. Whereas if we had a bank of washrooms, we could walk in, people could be in a stall, we could check on them. So we've had to go in multiple times to bathrooms to help people who are not okay. But it's not optimal safety for anyone at that point. So we haven't engaged anyone as far as looking at that, because we just really got through finishing our kitchen last year that cost $200,000 because of all the issues, you know, in renovating an older building. So we figured these bathrooms will cost us $100,000.
I would say that I don't think we've encountered any resistance from government. I mean, everyone we've talked to seems to understand and support the need for supportive housing. I mean, I think every level of government hopes that the other one is going to pay more than, you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, everybody's interested in who's, you know, where the money's going to come from, and they want to help support, but, you know, it remains to be seen how all that will shake down, but nothing but support. I don't think we have encountered nothing but support.
Okay, good. I'll ask you a follow-up question then, Sheila and Leisha. Just, I wondered if you could elaborate on what it means to be a not-for-profit landlord and what that organizational model looks like and manifests in the community.
Essentially, it really means that we don't generate profit from owning the properties that we do, that any profit as a nonprofit, any profit we generate has to be reinvested in the community. And so for the last many, many years, until this year, Kindle had never taken a dime of government funding. We had always funded the Sheldale Center and other properties that we'd purchased from the rents that we generate. And over the years, the rents that we had generated in the Sheldale Center in particular, for some tenants had been deeply affordable, like very, very affordable. And so, and we paid the building off, you know, we've owned it for 18 years, we paid it off, we maintained it. We're currently renovating it now, and we're engaging back into a mortgage in order to bring it into the 21st century, like in order to make sure it looks like a welcoming place and a place that we care about, which I think tells the people who use it lots. Our goal is to manage spaces for the community, for families, for kids, for individuals to use, and not use the profit for any other purpose. So we're a nonprofit organization and have to comply with those rules. And right now we're looking actually at gaining charitable status so that we can accept donations and give tax receipts. And so we're currently in the process of that. That was after some good thinking about what Kindle should do. And so we're headed in that direction now.
I think the other thing too, with just being a nonprofit landlord, is we're in this for the long run, right? So CMHC has a question around, you know, how long will the units be affordable? And there's this minimum standard, which is what most, you know, developers pick of 20 years. Kindle has committed to exceeding that already. We doubled it and put down 40. So I think that's also one of the great advantages of a project of this nature and having Kindle as the owner operator is that it's going to be affordable for its history, right? We're not interested in ever shifting that. That is our mission and our mandate. So,
okay, good. Thank you. I'm going to move now to some questions that have been coming up in the chat. The first one that came up was actually submitted in advance by Morgan. Morgan, you were asking about how the Royal City Mission has been responding and just how the whole kind of ecosystem of poverty relief services have been responding to the drop-in center no longer being open for food or for 24/7 warming and cooling. So Kevin, that's a big question, but I wonder if you could start to tackle that one. And then Morgan, if you follow up afterwards, you can jump in.
So I don't know if most of you know, but we talk as organizations. So since the very beginning of all of this stuff, Gail, myself, Rochelle from Community Health Center, and Jaya from Hope House, we've tried to be in conversation. And so when the drop-in was moving and changing what they were doing, it was never before they said, hey, like, we're thinking of this. Is there any way people can fill in these gaps? So it was never just like, something was closed and nobody knew about it. There was always time to have a conversation and say, like, how can we support this? Because it's been necessary. I don't know if you've seen people that you would have regularly seen downtown, but our experience has been those people who have been in the emergency shelter for the last few months, they are different people, completely different people. You can have regular conversations with them. It's just a different world when you have a place to stay. We have tried to do everything we can, but of course, we're a quite a small organization. So we're just filling in what we can do. I don't know if that fully answers the question. But also Hope House that's why they've taken on a breakfast and we've taken on other things. And then the drop-in hasn't, just jumped ship. So, Emmanuel, who is one of the drop-in staff, is working at Royal City, paid for by the drop-in. So he is cooking and working with us, but on behalf of the drop-in. So we're just working together to try to make it work. And I do know that the question came up of the warming center. There is plans for the Warming Center to be open in November. I just haven't got confirmation from the organization that's doing that yet. So I don't know if they've, I'm not sure if it's been announced.
Okay, well, we'll keep our ears open for that one then. Juanita had asked just to know a little bit more about how your open use washrooms have been working, Kevin. Just in terms of protocols and you know, how to make sure proper care is taken of the facilities. So you can go ahead of that one.
Are we talking about the porta potty or our bathrooms in the church? Because, well, it's sort of the same thing. We clean between each use of the bathroom. We've already had to have disinfectant spray for everything we do anyway. So we clean them between. And same with the porta potty is a little more difficult. We check a few times a day, but it's been in pretty good shape and it's cleaned once a week by the porta potty company. And that has been a support. So that's actually the Downtown Business Association. They provided the porta potty with, you know, in partnership. They said, we know that you have property and that you'd be willing, and we know there's a problem. So this was like sort of a quick solution. It's not the best solution, but it's a solution.
So I'll just move to the next question for you again, Kevin. This one's from Barb. Just wondering if there are children who are using your services and what percentage of your users.
Right. So children. That's a question that is kind of pre-COVID and now. So prior to COVID, we had quite a few families that would come when they were struggling and come to meals. Bring their children. But it's not a huge percentage. I would say probably 5% of the people that would come. We like them to come with family. So if someone shows up that's a child to an evening program, we would be very concerned and would be contacting different organizations about that because, you know, that's a problem. So anybody that's, you know, looking under 15, we would have a conversation with. Even at 15, I have conversations with people, you know, where are you going tonight? What's going on? But currently we're not seeing any children other than a couple people that would bring babies, but people are picking up food for their families. So the meal right now is served out front. People can come and grab to-go meals, and we don't ask questions. If someone says, I have three children, I need meals, we just give them as many meals as they ask for. So that's how we're engaging that. But we haven't kept track of exactly how many children we're sending meals out, but there are families.
Okay.
I'm just wondering whether Kendall wants to talk about that in the context of the Sheldale Center, because Sheldale supports a lot of families. Any input from either Alicia or Sheila?
Just on, I'm not sure what you're asking, Phil.
Whereas the Royal City Mission is very mindful about child security from the perspective of being on the streets and perhaps alone. The difference is that in the Kindle project in the Sheldale area right now, there is a tremendous focus upon children and child safety. I was just wondering whether you wanted to comment on the services that are currently offered in there.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, Family and Children Services is one of the partners at Sheldale. So there's a team of, there are two couple teams of folks over there that support families. And so do most of the organizations there support families. So there's lots of support for kids and families. Having said that, and I think a lot of the programs have started running again, but the programs have not been as operational since the beginning of COVID. So, you know, I think it's a pretty, you know, there's lots of safeguards there. And Kevin, I don't know if you know, but I also am the executive director at Family and Children Services. So I'm sure that if you had concerns that it's our organization, you'd be calling you know, but I think families they're not taking their kids out like they were before COVID. So, you know, we're not seeing people out and about in the same way. And I think it's fantastic to know that families can come pick up meals and I think, you know, one of the messages that I've been giving to the community in general is we all need to be, you know, vigilant about noticing families that need support and encouraging people to call. Our organization in particular, people think that, you know, often have stereotypes about what Family and Children Services does, but we actually, the vast majority of the work we do is supporting families, not using our authority to take them away. Like, you know, that's a huge stereotype. So.
All right. I've got a couple more questions in the queue. One being, what is the relationship of both of your services and organizations to the Guelph Police Services? And the question is, to what degree do police get involved in your work? So let's maybe go with Sheila and Leisha and then Kevin this time.
Well, I would say Kindle doesn't really have a big relationship with the police, but Family and Children Services, of course, does. But we work very collaboratively. And, you know, again, you know, it's, you know, a small percentage of the cases that we work with where we would work with police involvement. Most of our work is done voluntarily with families. When they need our support, or when, you know, somebody in the community tells us that somebody's struggling and they think a child, you know, might be unsafe. But, you know, we work collaboratively, we co-team, you know, when we have to, and yeah.
For us, we have a great relationship with the downtown constables. Particularly Mark O'Connell has been amazing for us. He drops in regularly. People like him. We haven't always had that situation, but we rarely have calls to the police for emergencies, which people find hard to believe. But the reality is we've, in the 10 years I've been there, we've had very little. You know, you get 120 people in a room, people who are struggling. You can expect to see some problems. We've had very little, very, very little. And I'm not sure what that is, but I'm thankful. So we rarely call the police, but they do come in and hang out with us if they need to. And we've tried to make them welcome also in our space, but they are great when they come. They usually just find me and say, I'm looking for this person. Can you let them know? Instead of just coming in, you know, going through the place and causing havoc, they've been really respectful and great. And I think it's a great relationship. We're really happy with the downtown, the group that's there.
Yeah, and I would add to that I think a lot of the time when we need police support, it's really when somebody's really upset and chances are mental health is the issue, and the police are called to just help keep the peace, you know, and yeah. help us get somebody settled down, or, you know, and when they can, I think CMHA, the impact team, you know, comes along with, but that doesn't happen very often.
So you were saying about, I of course have to ask about impact, right? Because do you guys call impact when there's someone having a mental health crisis, or is it just the police? I ask because that's something that we read about, that there's a partnership, so that it's police and mental health professionals coming together to respond to such crises, rather than just police who are not necessarily, they don't have that expertise.
I don't know if you want to go, Kevin, or you want me to. I mean, I would just say that I think it's not, I'm the executive director. It's been a long time since I did frontline work, and I do hear lots of how things work. But my understanding is, and I could be wrong about this, is that when the impact team works closely with the police, so if you need them, they come with. I think the police make that decision, or we direct that decision by our description of what's happening. But Kevin, do you?
That's my understanding as well. We've never directly called the impact team. And again, we've almost never called the police based on a mental health need. That is, we stay with people or we go to the hospital with them. Like we don't feel the need to escalate that situation. But we also have time, right? That's sort of the thing. I have time and I often go to the hospital with people and have a great relationship with the social worker there. But that's my understanding as well, Sheila, that when you call the police,
And that would be the same for our staff. I think where they get called is more to someone's home when they're struggling, and maybe a community call has come in or somebody in the residence has called. But that would probably be a question more for CMHA and the police in terms of how that actually works. Yeah. But if we needed immediate assistance, I don't think CMHA has the capacity to respond like immediately.
Right.
Okay. Wouldn't be our first
call. Or after hours when we're like sort of there, right? Like most of our program has been after 9 to 5. So there is only usually police around.
Okay. Thanks everyone for that. I'll move on to the last question that I have from the chat. And then I'll make another opening for our phone guests, just in case they wanted to jump in. But Morgan was asking about, some people are being moved from the temporary program at the hotels and now being asked to move to Ignatius instead. Are there any concerns about service and relief gaps being present, or any difficulties on your end in this ecosystem of providing services all the way out in the Ignatius area? I know as a person who's carless, I definitely understand that Ignatius is a fair hike away if you're by bike or by foot. But there are some, you know, shops and things, the Walmart's close by and whatever else. But anyway, from your perspective, what is that going to look like? Are there any particular challenges?
Oh, there's definitely lots of challenges, but there's always been challenges with having our shelter system. Our shelter system is across from St. Ignatius. I don't, like, the men's shelter is directly across the road. But the hotels were also that far away, being the Hotel 8 and the Holiday Inn Express. That's quite far to get back downtown for other services. So there's definitely issues, but it's, I think they're the best solutions that we have right now. Getting people there, there's been a bit of a gap because things have been full. So it's been hard to get people on lists. It's been all these things, but no, there isn't bus service to St. Ignatius. There's only bus service up to Walmart, and then people would have to walk, unfortunately. We have been sending people if they need by taxi, but that gets pricey too. And the drop-in also has an account that they send people by taxi. So
yeah, just following up on that, I have driven people to the Super 8 before when I've been, and it is an unusual form of volunteerism, but if people are willing, it's certainly needed.
Yeah. And it'll be needed out at St. Ignatius, I'm sure. But there are gaps.
Yeah, safe to say. I think, Morgan, unless you wanted to follow up on that question, I think we're done with our question list. And not hearing anything from Morgan, so we'll continue along. I want to make one more space for our phone guests, just in case you have any questions or comments that have been on your mind. So anybody who dialed in by phone, the floor is yours right now if you want it. And I'm hearing nothing there as well. So I think we're just going to move to some closing. So I wondered for everybody who's a guest today, you know, we've got some politically involved people in this room right now, people who are able and potentially willing to volunteer to write letters to the editor, to send money to in certain directions. So I'll ask both of you, what could this group of people do in reciprocity for you guys to help with your causes? Let's go with Sheila and Leisha first.
I think, you know, there's a lot of power in individuals talking positively about the need for the services and supports and dispelling myths. And, you know, I think with supportive housing, you know, one of the big myths is, you know, they're going to be these horrible people that are all going to be living in this building, you know, close to me. And the reality is they're not horrible people. They're just people that have had struggles. And I loved, you know, Kevin, I think you said that that you've seen such a huge improvement in the people that you serve just because they have a place to sleep at night. Sleep is a big part of people's health and safety and security. And, you know, I myself have seen, and Leisha probably has seen in her work at Wyndham House for many, many years, when people have a place that they feel safe and secure, their health improves. And these people are already in our community, and they're going to be better off, not worse off. And so I think, you know, anything that you can do as individuals in your circles, support politically, you know, letters of support, all of that is super, super important. And just, you know, helping to respond to and contribute to the positive messaging that I think is sorely needed for each and every one of these projects to be able to get launched and to do the good work that needs to happen to improve, you know, life in our community for everybody.
I would echo that, Sheila, just that positive narrative. I know I've been at this for 15 years and working in homelessness and making sure everyone has a safe place to call home. And I personally have never been so hopeful. We have a community that is rallying together right now. We have projects popping up in our media, in our community, in multiple communities across our city and in Guelph, Wellington. And I'm really, really hopeful. Like, I get a lot of goosebumps lately around, like, we're going to do this. And so just keeping that narrative really positive. This is a celebration. This is something to be proud of. Guelph Wellington is a community champion, I think, across the province and across the country. People are looking to us, and I really think we can do this.
Ran out of time again. That's all. Thanks, as always, to our guests. And to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Alt, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thank you for any support you can lend, and as always, for listening.